If it happened again, I'd call the person and if somebody said, if this happens again, you're going to see a telegram come across your desk to the ambassador pointing out that the message was not appropriately cleared by the Department of State and that he should ignore it or have the office involved ignore it. That worked. But much more than that kind of threat is simply getting to know the people well. Treating these bureaucratic wars that have gone on will always go on. I've always felt that most of us are trying to work more or less towards the same ends. Our national interests, we might view them somewhat differently depending where you sit. But that most problems in Washington, if you get the time, can be worked out, not all, by simply having everybody work like hell together. And so I, obviously operational messages, personnel messages, all that kind of trash went out. They never bothered me with it. But after I'd been on the job 6 months or so, I did not view that any longer as a problem.
Now, in October 74, before Kissinger traveled to Iran, a November visit, Clark McGregor of United Aircraft wrote him a letter asking about the proposals for helicopter co-production. Apparently, United Aircraft, through Sikorsky Division, Boeing and Bell were all competing for the same contract at this point. And McGregor was worried that Bell had a political edge over the others, over United and Boeing. And he asked Kissinger to let the Shah know that the U.S. supported the idea of equal opportunity, that he was free to choose from any of the three competitors when he made the decision on who would do the co-production of helicopters. Was this issue brought to your attention?
Yeah, I knew about, I'd forgotten until you raised it again, I'd forgotten about that particular competition. But, and this is relying on a fairly weak memory, I think the Iranians were given all three proposals. But Bell obviously had the edge right from the beginning.
What explains that?
Because they were already running a helicopter training program, and the Iranians had already bought a large number of Bell helicopters. I mean, Bell, I don't know how, what Bell's eventual employment in the country just in this training program was. So they had the edge simply by their presence and by the Iranians' general satisfaction with the particular helicopter. So I said a lot of the Bell employees came from very diverse backgrounds and created a myriad of problems for the consuls and for the embassy. But I think the Iranians were generally satisfied, and Bell came up with the co-production proposal, which the Iranians did accept. But again, to the best of my memory, all three proposals. Whether Kissinger raised it himself, I honestly can't remember. But I do know that we tried to be very, very careful on that sort of thing to make sure that competing firms had as reasonably a fair opportunity. Part of frankly is cover your ass. But I never wanted to be in a position where I could be charged with unfairly favoring a particular manufacturer. Right? Would have been ruinous to me personally as well as the State Department and the government. So I was quite careful on that sort of thing. I think the state was very careful on that too. Political military affairs would be heavily involved in this kind of stuff. You know, PM, you know. And they had to be very, very careful. But, you know, like Caesar's wife sort of thing.
And you mentioned earlier this, I think I mentioned this a wee bit earlier, but March 75, Kissinger and Hushang Ansari signed off this $15 billion non-arms export agreement. I guess it was signed in Zurich. March 75, I think. Well, that was one of the big deals.
The sign here in Washington, at least the big deal, the really big deal, the sign here in Washington in the State Department, the great flourish. In fact, it was one of those amusing things, because after the joint communique was agreed upon, you know, last minute fiddling around with the Texas, the Iranians kept trying to get more stuff into it, and I kept fighting them all. Or I'd put some, had the thing typed, to my terrible embarrassment, I missed a major typographical error where the material actually some material was left out. I was so tired at the point I didn't know, so stuff had to be retyped by the Treaties Affairs Division. So by the time we had the meeting in Washington, they didn't have the full texting that was in it generally. And Kissinger made a joke. He said, we got the last page up to the, you know, little folders and all that. And if I'm really, this is how much I trust my Iranian colleague. He said, I'm just saying, I'm taking a poke kind of thing. But he showed up and said, all I got is the last page of my sitting type. He signed it. And I escaped the thing, having my career ended at that point, but the tough situation came down and was okay. But the delay was one of my oversights. But Red Post was, along with Chuck Robinson, were the driving forces in the larger issues on some of this. And where they ever got the figure of 15 million, whatever it was, I never could understand. As I told you, I think earlier, Red called me and I said, well, you figure it out yourself. And I sat down and made a series of assumptions of what we might sell here. And it didn't come to that at all. You know, so it's one of those grandiose little things.
As you mentioned earlier, this agreement included provisions for the sale and construction of nuclear power generating plants. The construction of nuclear power plants raised an issue. You sort of alluded to already the question of nuclear non-proliferation. Apparently the Shah wanted the right to reprocess spent nuclear fuel, mm-hmm. while the Ford administration was concerned about the possibility of misuse for military purposes. Now, how was this issue handled, question of reprocessing the spent fuel?
You know, it's the one issue that I might have difficulty commenting on fully, because the materials are still considered classified on this. But yeah, right, the Shah's insistence on having what he called complete control of the entire fuel cycle process was the stumbling block right from 1974 on. We struggled with that one in a whole variety of ways. One of guys in policy planning came up with the brilliant idea of regional reprocessing plants in which we would have a say in investment. Shah rather liked that idea, but I'm going to forget why that didn't get off the ground. And so it really wasn't until 1978, the summer of 1978, that we finally reached agreement on the on that particular agreement. And I can't go into details. One thing I know is still considered quite sensitive how we handle that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not avoiding it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe someday.
And frankly, it's not that sensitive. But I know that, for example, in my current job, of part-time job, of requests have come for all the documentation on the negotiations and the final texts and all that. And we've never released all those texts. I think some people know pretty well what's in them.
But well, there's certain safeguards were for some, I take it.
That's all sorts of.
Yeah.
Very complicated agreement. And I know the last time somebody from Carnegie Foundation, expert in this area, asked for this agreement, I checked through and was told that it was still considered classified and sensitive.
Now, you mentioned earlier your assistance, the time you spent working with representatives of arms corporations and other corporations involved in Iran in terms of investment and trade and activities generally. Were most of the businessmen were most of the firms that were involved in Iran or interested in Iranian markets, were they mostly large corporations, Fortune 500 types, or?
After the period of 1974-1975, I think any American who thought he had a saleable idea went to Iran. I remember Ambassador Meyer having gone out for, I forget what purpose, and he had to sleep on the pool table of one night of one of the hotels, and not a hotel room available. The British, the Americans, the French, everybody who thought he had a great idea was out there. I remember some of the wildest people came through my office to get a general briefing on Iran as they went out to try to sell the Shah some part of the government on how important the sultan he could be in a particular area. So at the beginning, you had companies of all levels, individuals, some pretty disreputable ones, frankly, went out there trying to get their hand into the golden pie. I did my best now and then to discourage some individuals, but again, I was on thin ice of telling them not to go. And I'd say, you know, if I were you, I'd save my money and not go. But some of the companies did their own work. GE, for example, had been in the country some time. You've talked with Bill Layfield. AT&T got the contract to do the major communications system. U.S. auto firms were interested, were there, tire firms, and they largely did the work for themselves. They were interested primarily, in the Iranian, sharing the Iranian domestic market. Some firms felt that perhaps in the long-term future, when Iranian manufacturing skills and the quality of the product came out, that it might be a regional export for them as well. But the primary thing is that you might have a domestic market.
Now, according to Moshe's memorandum, the Iran desk as well as the embassy spent considerable time assisting U.S. businessmen, as you've already indicated. And was it a type of aid you'd give them, mostly information as to the market?
Yeah. The market and general advice. I know the Council for Economic Affairs and the Commercial Attaché probably on a slow day would see five or six business people who are coming through, or people already established who would drop in to brief him on how their project was going. And a lot of the advice would be given on simply the market as we saw it in our wisdom, but also how you operated within the Iranian business and political situation. There's a excellent Airgram that came out in 73, 74 on corruption in Iran. That was recently released. I can't give you the name of the person to whom it was released, but
Well, they felt work on that.
Yeah,
I've seen that. Yeah.
You've seen that.
It's in the capture documents.
Yeah.
Also.
As that kind of thing, it started to concern this. If you've seen a document, then you know what our concerns were, too. And, of course, that became a very ill-taken action. It became a real headache for me as country director. For example, the Grumman deal with an Iranian, I can't say 5%, that was more than that. Became a real bit of friction in the relationship, mostly with between Grumman and General Tufani and the Iranian in that particular organization. But I got heavily involved in it because all the people from Grumman kept me informed, came down and talked to me, etc., and wanted our help. Not much we could do about it. You had some of the same problems with Lockheed, had a small problem. These were charges by maybe overcharges, some by error, not by error. So our interest in possible corruption or the misuse of the middleman remained a problem. And right up to the last days when Ross Perot's people were seized on various charges, which I'm convinced were incorrect. So but that was a continuous problem for the embassy. And a lesser problem for me, but when I went there, of course, the Ross Perot problem in the month of December and January was a major headache for me.
Mm-hmm. That's something I should have mentioned earlier, but around the same time the agreement, the $15 billion agreement was announced and signed, Shah agreed to provide more oil to Israel to induce the Israelis to withdraw from the Sinai Peninsula as part of the Arab-Israeli agreement that Kissinger was trying to forge during this period. Did you have any role in this discussion over this question?
No. As you know, part of the Sinai withdrawal, we agreed, sort of as the provider of last resort, if oil was shut off, we would either provide or help Israel find other sources. I was aware that we had Iran's understanding or agreement that it would continue to provide oil. I played no personal role. This was strictly the secretary and so on.
You know, the Shah needed any inducements to go along with this arrangement or this?
I'm unaware of any. Again, the Shah would view this as a natural step. I mean, he was very interested by this time, was developing a relationship with Saddam. Would have been in favor of the policy of withdrawal from the Sinai, and if he could provide sort of on the edges help, assistance, he would see this, would have seen this as in Iran's interest. And there's no necessity for quid pro quo. Back to the points I made earlier, he generally had, his Weltanschauung was pretty much the same as ours.
Now, in 1975, the Shah, I guess, visited Washington for the first time, which is that you were country dress director. He visited Washington, meeting with President Ford and Secretary Kissinger and so forth. Did this visit have a particular purpose that you can recall? Was this to meet the president or?
Basically, the Shah wanted to meet every president. And he had. And so a lot of we received indications from him that he had met Ford before, but that he wanted to visit the president. And we saw this as part of the alliance relationship as a very natural kind of thing. I forget, I really do forget what our briefing papers had in terms of what we were expecting from the visit, but essentially a goodwill kind of thing. And I must say the Shah was very pleased with the visit.
Now, during the visit, the Shah met with James Schlesinger of the Defense Department and others to discuss the possibility of buying Boeing 707s with AWACS systems. I guess that was the first time this was brought up, I think, this question of getting AWACS. How did this request go over, do you recall? The AWACS issue at this stage?
I really don't remember. Mm-hmm. Schlesinger, as Secretary of Defense, was more skeptical about Iran's absorptive capacity as well as some of the geopolitical thinking that went into the policy. But as the guy in charge of all the people who were out there, he was greatly concerned about the possibilities of corruption by American firms, overzealous pitch for the Iranians to buy things. So I don't really recall. I know the subsequent steps, of course, is that we did a dual survey. We made a major survey of a ground-based radar system in lieu of AWACS. And I read all the papers and I participated in writing all our State Department testimony on the AWACS thing. And we went into, the experts concluded, and I think this is probably an honest assessment, is that a ground-based radar system in the long term would be far more costly, almost impossible really, because, have an effect of, I've seen all the maps of where areas that wouldn't be covered properly, etc. And that, particularly in terms of Iranian manpower, that a ground-based radar, a really effective ground-based radar system, would be far more demanding in manpower and eventually, probably in terms of money, and that, therefore, AWACS made sense. The, as Lockheed has their P-3, And of course, the Lockheed people felt that the P-3, which the Iranians already had, if you really could do the job, and Lockheed was given full opportunity to make its case. In fact, the Shah became, I remember one time, really quite annoyed because we wanted one more, the Lockheed had one more chance. And I said, I've already made up my mind, I want AWACS. I know what the P-3 can do, I've got it. But there were, up on the hill, I remember during the testimony, and talking to you, there's some belief that Boeing, you know, that's something, you know, us working together with Boeing against Lockheed. This is true and not true. So say the P-3 program, the Lockheed people had full opportunity to present their proposal of the use of P-3. And the Navy, of course, was interested in this. The Navy uses the P-3 at the time. There's no doubt that the Defense Department was in part swayed towards AWACS versus the P-3, is that there was a break in production on the AWACS. We had not yet convinced, we were trying to convince the Europeans and others to buy AWACS, and no European country had yet made, this is my memory, had yet made a decision to buy AWACS. So you had a real production, and our own purchases of AWACS were staggered out. And there was a break in the production line in there that the sale of AWACS to Iran would have filled in nicely. We kept the production line going, it would have. And one interest of the Pentagon in any arms sale is obviously that it will cut the unit costs for them too. And you always put in a little charge for research and development, so you get some of your money back. I never heard anybody call this a driving factor. It was a factor people took into account. You charge 4%. And of course, your airplane is sold for $18 million. There's some R&D money in that that the company gets back on, and we get, and might cut our unit cost. So that's always an interest. So you had this, that dual interest. I think people honestly felt that the AWACS was the better airplane, but also fitted in better with our own use of AWACS and continued design to make it the principal battle control station in Europe.
Now, you mentioned earlier James Schlesinger's concerns about absorptive capacity and economic implications of the arms sales for Iran's internal economy. To what extent were officials in the State Department beginning to share those concerns at any level? For example, I read in the 76 Senate Foreign Relations Committee report on arms sales that indicates that some people at the middle level and lower level of the State Department were worried about these very same concerns that Schlesinger was concerned about. Did you get a sense of
this? I was concerned by these problems. Yet, I had a dual reaction often to the statement, my God, how can they absorb it? And I had a lot of discussions at the Pentagon with this, and I was pointing out that when we first went into F-5 program, how are they going to handle it? They handled it very well over a period of time. So to mention, we had one or two people in the country of our own on the P-5, on the F-5 program. Lockheed had its own people there who helped out. A lot of our manufacturers had their own representatives at American military bases. That's not unusual. They absorbed and handled the F-4 program very well. So you had a history where over a period of time, the Iranians proved quite competent to handle the infusion of new systems. So I felt that over time, a lot of these other new systems would be absorbed, probably at far more expense than the Iranians thought, far more problems, a lot of headaches involved, but that they could eventually handle these problems. That was not, you know, if the Shah thought something was going to be thoroughly absorbed by, say, 85, my feeling was probably be 1990. but that it was doable. My other overriding attitudes came from part one, as policy had been made. But I felt that essentially the Shah was the sovereign of an important state. He had the money, but it was his decision to make. I argued strenuously at times that people policy planning, how terribly some of the younger people were concerned with it. I said, you know, Dad, it's his country. Well, maybe I was not prescient. Maybe I should have been very forceful on this, but you know, it was his country. Yeah, he's got his own ministers. He's got his own military people. Let them make their own bloody decisions themselves. He, you know, he's as intelligent as, let's say, you know, he's as intelligent as you are. And how do we know what the reaction's going to be in this country? Well, in part they were right, in part I was wrong. I'm sure, you know, all of these little things are little drops that eventually accumulated into the revolutionary current. But I felt, as I said, throughout my whole career, I just felt there was a minimum amount that we could get sovereign states to do. If you've got a big aid program going on, that's different, then you can control the flow of what you're selling or giving a country. When they're buying, as the Shah was, he picked what he wanted. And he was not above going, as we know, he bought the British Chieftain tank. When we were slow coming up with the nuclear cooperation agreement, he signed agreements and had contracts with the Germans and the French. So that I just didn't feel we had quote the leverage that everybody thinks, not sure we try to use it that much.
Now, during 73 to 75, James Schlesinger was concerned about these problems that you mentioned, and he first sent Richard Halleck to work with the Shah, worked out to Fadi on these issues, and later on sent Eric von Marburg in 75 as senior defense representative, who would have even more, who sort of supervised the MAGS operations and the arms sales program in Iran generally. Now, how much support did the plan for the senior defense representative have at the State Department? What was the response to that one when it proposed?
Let me take one step backwards. Okay. I'm not sure what the status of it is, but probably the best document is the Blitchin report. I don't know whether Scott Armstrong has it, but
I haven't seen it. Yeah.
I know it was in part of the documents that were reviewed for the white paper, but since it was a DOD document, I can't recall. In the process, you come across another agency's document, but Blitchin, B-L-I-T-G-E-N, Glenn Blitchin, was pulled out of his job and made sort of stressing as a special assistant to really look into the problems that were developing. And that's a scary report. I mean, it's just more fears rather than proof of the fears in the future. I didn't see that report till very late. Glenn and I were friends to go back to the 50s, but he was under instruction by Schlesinger show to no one, to share his views with no one until it was all done. And Glenn held to it, and I pressed him to tell me what was going on. He wouldn't. He said, I can't tell him. when the idea first came for Eric von Marburg to go out, I'd say we were supportive, not wildly supportive. Ambassador Helms was at first concerned about this a new very senior person coming out, and I suppose part of it, I'm just not sure what he viewed it as, a sort of a comment upon his administration of the mission or not. Anyways, I personally convinced him he had to come back. Showed me the various messages, a couple which I had not seen, or at least raising the idea. And we went over, and I told him that the heat was such, and there's enough interest in it by Schlesinger, and concern on the part of everybody, that things could get out of control and lead to a whole riot of scandals. You know, the pressure on them was heavy from the Hill, and that I thought, even regardless of what Eric did, that his assignment should not be opposed. I didn't understand. Stuff has gone back, but I didn't understand the full history. Because I think from now on, our main problem is working out, and your main concern should be working out sort of the terms of the agreement of what his responsibilities are, the extent, nature, etc., and get that written down with your agreement and DOD and state agreement, which was done. Sid Silver did more of the actual drafting and work on that than I did. I was busy with a whole variety of other things. And so I think, you know, in retrospect, yeah, I think Schlesinger, in part, was a cover your ass thing. See what we're doing. And we recognize the problem too, Seneca. But it was also out of a sincere concern, because the Butchin Report is you know, was pretty damning, at least damning in terms of what could happen. So I think Eric did a hell of a good job out there. He really took control. I mean, everybody agreed he did a marvelous job. It was so good, in fact, that when he finally decided he wanted to come home, I think he felt, and the embassy felt, that the situation was sufficiently controlled, that we didn't need another defense. And we sent in Phil Gast, who, you know, as Army Schmag Chief, and Phil was a super manager. But that was one of those little things that turned out to be a very useful step.
Now, Schlesinger remained concerned about the follow arms sales, and in late 75, he requested President Ford to authorize an NSC level reconsideration of U.S. policy towards Iran. Now, what did the State Department, or rather, Kissinger, think about this proposal to reconsider policy at the NSC level? How did this go over?
Like a lead balloon. The last thing that Kissinger wanted was a re-examination of policy and the intrusion of the Secretary of Defense or anybody else into his management of foreign affairs. As you know, that request sat with the NSC for a long time. And it finally came out as to do a study of Iran and the whole Persian Gulf. That was not accidental, the fact that it was broadened. And it was, let's put it this way, a number of minds got together and decided that this, you couldn't kill the idea, but the best way to handle it was to broaden the subject. So frankly, you made it almost unmanageable. I say a couple of fairly active minds to get into that on that. Of course,
even the NSC staff people did that, or?
And a few people at state. But we, as you know, the study eventually was done. And it was an enormous piece of paper, my God. And done at the very end of the Ford, as I recall, at the very end of the Ford administration, the paper was completed. Nissan 200 and something, I forget what the hell it was. It was a useful work, I mentioned. Of course, we were under pressure too, you know, from the Hill. We made a commitment to look at our entire policy in the area of the Senate, the Humphrey, during, I'm not sure, maybe in the AWACS or in the S-60 and then Humphreys and others, we finally were forced in the Carter, I guess it's in the Carter period, we were finally forced to make a concession that we'd not send any large arms programs, further arms sales up to the Hill until we had done a thorough study of policy. That's toward the end of my period and I'd left, thank God. Those kind of papers are pretty awful. That's all right. But
has it been declassified?
I don't know.
Now, in August 76, Kissinger visited the Shah again, and there they announced a plan for additional arms sales to Iran. The Shah would buy $10 billion in arms under this plan. This would be part of a $50 billion program that would last between 76 and 1980, ostensibly. Now, was this another case of numbers sort of being made up, like the other, the earlier agreement, the $15 billion agreement involving the nuclear power plants?
I don't think so. I have a pretty, I forget the entire contents of what was proposed in that program.
Yeah.
But he, we had a pretty good understanding, so, you know, what 160 S-16s would cost, and what...
it was of all the S-16 sales. Yeah. Yeah, right.
So you had a pretty good idea what your costs were on that, on the big discussion on that particular problem was delivery time. And Michel wanted very quick delivery on F-16s, which the Pentagon opposed simply because it would cut into our own S-16 program. We worked out a compromise with the Pentagon and with the Shah, which we gave a little, and he withdrew a little bit in terms of time of delivery and amounts.
Does it have any other reasons, any other purposes besides the announcement of this arms agreement?
It really, it was just a, I'm not sure where Kissinger went entirely on that visit. I can remember preparing the first briefing paper for him, in which, the sort of way you do this, you know, you have a general statement of your objectives and all this, and then maybe a whole list of separate paragraphs or pages of issues that may come up. Issues the Shah may raise, issues we want to raise. And I remember Kissinger had a meeting though with Roy Atherton and me, George Best was head of PM, a few other people, of looking ahead to the visit. I mean, what am I going to do out there? He said, he picked up my paper, which I thought was brilliant. He said, I know all this geopolitical, I used a four-letter word, what else am I going to do? I'll show you the F-16 program, and these are the problems. I know all about that. You know, we have a list of all sorts of little things that might work. But there's no major purpose in the visit.
Around the same time, when they met, apparently the Senate Committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report on arms sales was released in the same month.
Yeah, that was
Kissinger and the Shah made comments on it at their at their press conferences. What did you think about the report?
At the time, I was more concerned, I must admit, and here's where I say a country director by nature becomes a bit of a special pleader. I was a little concerned, although when I saw the first draft, I was more concerned with some of the tone of it. I felt, frankly, part of it was insulting. I'm looking at a very narrow viewpoint at that point of what impact is this going to have on our relationship as a totality? What kind of problems is it going to create for me and for the State Department? So in working, I worked with the people on the draft and was able to persuade them to change some of it, drop some of it, not nearly as much as a special advocate in the sense that I would have liked to have seen taken up. But they were very cooperative in revising some of the language and content to make it less objectionable. In retrospect, obviously, this is a damn good report. Yeah. To point out all the problems. They did Bob Mantell and did a very good job on that.
That's interesting.